Evening all.
There he is.
Yeah. Sorry, minor keyboard problem.
Okay.
Is it covered in lasagna?
No. Couldn't find any old mouse. So I could see the call coming in. I just couldn't answer it.
Right.
The UK's leading technology podcast.
Yeah, what an advert.
We are on it.
Right.
Word.
Is that a harp in the background then?
It's, I say, my wife is playing a harp.
Now listen to that.
We, on the plus side, we now only have one harp. We did have two.
Everything is stereo.
And welcome to the AV Forums podcast for the 4th of June. And joining me on this edition, Assistant Editor Steve Withers.
Kurt, I need you to take me inside.
News Editor Mark Hodgkinson.
Do you know him?
Games Editor Mark Botwright.
Call me Iceman.
Some geezer called Simon Crest who comes around here now and again.
What do you intend to do? Scratch it with your claws?
And audio reviewer Ed Selly.
And the next time you feel like showing off, don't.
Jesus Christ, it's June. Where's half the year gone? It's just flown by. And at the end of this month, the AV Forums podcast will be taking its summer holiday, which basically means we won't be around in July because we're all off sunning ourselves on nice beaches around the world. So more on that. As
speak for yourself.
Yeah. I'm going to the lake, dude.
You are.
So anyway, more on that closer to the time, but it is a new month, so let's go into some hardware news. And before we do the article stuff, let's look at what we all have coming up in the month of June. So let's go to Steve first. So Steve, what are we expecting hardware-wise?
I've got the Samsung HU8200, which is a sort of the latest Ultra HD 4K TV that sits between the 8500 and the 7500 that Mark's just recently reviewed. That's coming in this week. And also I've got SVS's new SB2000 subwoofer, which I'm quite looking forward to playing with. I like a bit of serious bass in the room, and certainly the specs-wise, it looks good.
A subwoofer.
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 A subwoofer.
Ed Selly?
Well, obviously, it being the second of...
Sorry, I meant, we've just had a whole...
We're not going to
see
any reviews from you for another 4 weeks, are we?
Right, so I'll ask you in week three of the month, I think.
No. Joking aside, I've been having a chat to the lovely folks at PMC earlier today, and hopefully... I'm going to get something out of them. But in the meantime, there is actually another speaker package. I've been promising it for a while, and I will finally deliver it. The reason being they have in the meantime changed distributor, but there's a nice speaker package from Quadral due as well. I just need to get some of the 8 million boxes currently in my house out of my house, and then we're good to go.
I'm sure there's plenty of volunteers in the forums that would pop around and help you empty all those boxes, Ed.
Well, it's actually review samples waiting to go back, so if they did it, it'd be theft. But it's more if any of them are couriers, they are well welcome to give me a hand.
Mr. Hodge, what have you got coming up? Some Panasonics, I believe.
I do, yeah. Notably for the AX802, which is Panasonic's first 4K TV of the year. Just put that up. Looks all right so far. I got a LG Soundplay, a Samsung Soundbar, a Panasonic 4K Blue Player, and possibly something else. Oh, and yeah, a VBox PVR, network PVR.
Big month for games, Mark. E3 coming up, big games podcast as well.
Yep. We'll be recording that one literally right after the big press conferences, so we can, you know, give our reactions fresh as well. We should have, by the time this podcast goes out, a little E3 roundtable with all the games team about what we expect to see, who's excited about it to start with, to try and cut through a little bit of the apathy, as well as just general, a few little predictions. There have been lots of leaks so far, so we've tried to look more at things that we kind of predict more in hope than anything else. And then also we'll be covering all the big press conferences and hopefully getting up articles about them right after they happen.
Excellent. So if you're a gamer, we've got that to look forward to this month. And not forgetting the World Cup, which we're going to come to in a second. But finally, movie-wise, what's coming, Simon?
We've got quite a bunch coming up. The new RoboCop. Yay, we're all excited about that one. Non-stop, even better. Not really. Dallas Buyers Club, that's coming up. We've got Monuments Men as well. Grudge Match. We'll have the second season of House of Cards and Lone Survivor, amongst others.
Okay, so that's all the disc reviews that are coming up in June. And cinema-wise, Steve, what else have we got to look forward to? Because you're the only one that seems to go to the cinema, you and Kaz.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Right, this weekend it's 22 Jump Street, which is obviously the sequel to 21 Jump Street, really? Which I really enjoyed. So so that might be quite good. Oculus.
It was you, was it?
What?
That went to see it? Wow.
Oh, it was a big hit.
Yeah.
I'm assuming it was a big hit, otherwise they wouldn't have bothered making a sequel. The week after, Oculus, which is a horror film with Karen Gillan, who was originally in Doctor Who as one of his assistants. And then 3 Days to Kill, which opens up on our birthday, Mark Hutchinson, which I've already seen. I saw that last week and is okay. It's basically another film written by Luc Besson, and very much like every other film written by Luc Besson, but with this time with Kevin Costner playing an aging and dying CIA agent. Same weekend, we've got Jersey Boys. That's Clint Eastwood, who's directing, obviously, the stage play, the film version of the stage play. And then at the end of the month, Chef, with, who's in that? Who directed Iron Man? John Favreau. John Favreau, isn't it?
Okay, cool. And obviously, Clint Eastwood turned 81 last week as well.
He's getting on a bit, isn't he? He's still knocking him out. Can't believe it.
He's still knocking about, still working as well. So there you go. Yeah. Right, so we also June, World Cup. It starts next week. So, Mark, we've been doing a lot of features to try and help people get their picture and sound as best as they can coming up to the event. So you did two articles that we're going to talk about tonight. One was Don't Miss a Minute. So what was that all about?
Basically just about the wealth of streaming and internet possibilities that the 2014 World Cup affords. Obviously, we've never had more. There are a total of 4 continuous days of footballing action, and that's not taken into consideration extra time or penalties. So there's an awful lot to get in. They're fairly friendly kickoff times for us in the UK and Europe. So majority of matches are we'll start at 9 or 11 o'clock at night. So there's no excuse for missing those unless you have to get up really early. So we looked at, say, companion apps for PVRs, so the likes of TiVo or Sky or UView, or a few of the manufacturers have their own, allowing for things like remote recording. So you could suddenly realise you're going to miss the game and want to set it to record to watch when you get in. So there are a number of apps worth checking out your brand and model number to see if there is one for you. We looked at how not to spoil the results. So basically the best way of accessing the chase play feature of your PVR. And just a tip, don't get caught out by turning on the telly and having that channel tuned in. So always make sure you change channel before switching on the box or the TV. So I picked CBeebies and gave a few LCN numbers for the various platforms. What else did we look at? Not missing the extra time or the penalties. So that's basically looking at padding options for your PVR. So making sure you add on, you know, a good hour onto each recording, so you you don't have that frustration of missing out. Or the important action at the end.
Probably not so bad.
Well, as an English person, I think I put that actually. As an English person, it might be advisable. But anyway, we should probably endure the full pain and take it on the chin. We looked at BBC Sport app, the ITV player, which basically means you can watch anything, anywhere, and it's all available for free. And I'm very excited.
Excellent. So
I'd be more excited if it wasn't football. I mean, it's a magnificent technological achievement, but yay.
You've started early.
No, I'm...
It wasn't aimed at you, Ed, this one.
So the article is up on the site if you want to go and read that. And quite interesting, we're talking about new technology, because Steve, you are working on an article at the moment which looks at the history of the World Cup and how that ties into basically new technology coming along every time there is a major tournament.
Yeah, absolutely, Phil. The World Cup's been a testing ground for many a technology over the years, particularly when it comes to TV broadcasts, because obviously being one of the biggest, if not the biggest, world sporting event, I mean, other than possibly the Olympics, it's the major sporting event that almost all the world, apart from perhaps the United States, gets involved in. So obviously there's worldwide broadcasts. So you can go back as far as things like color broadcasts, obviously pink football, that was handy. You've got things like satellite broadcasting, obviously. And then more recently, at the last World Cup in South Africa, they were testing out 3D cameras. Didn't quite work out as they planned, obviously, but that's what they were testing at the time. And more recently, we've had, this year, we're going to have 4K being used extensively at the World Cup. Not broadcasting in 4K, obviously, but they will be testing the cameras. They'll be using different technologies, trying them out, basically, just testing out how to effectively use the cameras, how best to cover the games. And they will be broadcasting certain matches, particularly the final and semi-finals, in 4K in certain cinemas. So, again, another sort of pushing the envelope as far as TV technology goes at the World Cup.
One of the interesting things...
They are doing to make... I mean, goodness, when we'll see that.
8K is a pipe dream. And more than... literally a pipe dream, because you need a huge, huge data pipe. I don't see that happening any time in the next 10,
I don't know
years.
Yet, but I'll have to find out when they first tested high-def cameras at the World Cup, how many years that was before that became a reality.
I'm going to take a guess at 1998.
Yeah, it could be. Would have been around about then.
That'd be my guess. The other thing is, obviously, with 4K technology coming along, everybody automatically assumes that you need a 4K TV and all the rest of it. But actually, what broadcasters have been doing for a number of years, Steve, with 4K cameras, certainly Technicolor showed this at CES, Sony have a version of doing it as well, is they use two or three cameras, 4K cameras, but actually take HD feeds from it, because what they do is they have the camera covering a wide section of the pitch, but then they can zoom in to get a 1080 image from within that, and it allows them to use less cameras, more coverage, and they can get an HD broadcast signal using it that way.
Yeah, it's actually quite a clever idea, isn't it? You I think they actually use two 4K cameras doing half the pitch each, and then they just take a 1080p section and track it around, but only have to use two cameras. It is quite a clever way of utilizing technology now, even though we can't actually broadcast yet at a 4K resolution.
Okay, so that's the technology behind it. We've looked at how to keep up with the World Cup and make sure you don't miss a minute, or if you want to miss it, the best way is to miss it so you don't spoil the results. Which brings us to the sound side of things, something that Ed can get excited about if he's not excited about football. So the other article, Mark, was Bring the Noise, the World Cup sound solutions. What were you looking at within this article?
Spurious link-ups between countries and products. Is that what you want me to say? You don't want to say that, do you?
Yeah, it was pun-ridden, and I could tell you were clutching at straws, basically.
Well, yeah, okay. It came together, okay, as a sort of varied solution. We started off with the French entrance, which was recently reviewed by Ed. In fact, they look like footballs a little bit, which was the Ellipse and Planet LW and the Audio Bridge. I don't know. Did you talk about that in another podcast, Ed? I wasn't there.
I mentioned it briefly. We talked about it as it was something that I suggested as one. I was also busy suggesting that you should beam the signal onto the side of your house and annoy your neighbours. So it may or may not been taken with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, I missed that one, I'm afraid. So that was an alternative, posh alternative to soundbar solution. Then we came to a soundbar, which was the Japanese entry, the Pioneer SBX 300, which is a bargain basement soundbar, less than £200. Really, really good. Has a nice wide sound stage for crowd noises. What would I go for next? Here we go. South Korea Samsung HWF80 soundbar, which Steve reviewed towards the back end of last year. I've actually got the HWH715 at the minute, which looks very similar. Very, really nice, clean, lively sound. Quite impressive subwoofer for a soundbar package. And then we had the classy Dutch coming in with the Philips Fidelio E2, another 2.1 system. Oh no, it's just a 2.0 system, this one, isn't it? There's no woofer with that. Which, again, another alternative to a soundbar. Really nice, classy, velvety sound. And then we finished up with England, and that's where I was struggling, to be quite honest. sorry, Cambridge Audio. Cambridge Audio Minx TV, which is a sound-based type product, so you stick your TV on top of it, and it gives a rather boomy noise.
when did we review that?
I don't know. I don't know when I did it. Last year. You still buy it. It's still available.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
This matches up with the English team so well.
It does, rather, doesn't it? And I think Shane Doran on Twitter gave us the best reply to that article, which was, at AV Forums, turn the sound off would be my choice. And when it comes to World Cup commentary, I tend to agree with him.
I think Ed will probably agree with that one, won't you, Ed?
Football commentary, full stop. I mean, you can only do the cliche drinking game so many times before you get a bit headachy.
Yeah, and we told everybody how to get drunk last week. Yeah. So if they don't know how to get drunk, then
the only other one that you can do, not necessarily the only one, if you're bored, obviously any of the subtitles, and all the games will be subtitled. I believe they are obligated to be on UK television. But obviously the commentary has to be, converted live into text, so it's a rich breeding ground for hilarious typos, if that sort of thing amuses you, and I'm not afraid to say it does for me. I always find that tremendously entertaining, so that's always going for a laugh as well. And as Shane points out, you can listen to something far more satisfying in the meantime.
Excellent. So we're going to stick with the sound theme because we're going to go to hashtag Ask the Idiot. This is where we put an appeal out over the weekend and on a Monday for questions. And the experts here
will some topics to talk about.
We'll answer the questions. And yes, as Steve says, it's usually when we're struggling to find subjects to talk about. So anyway, Nacho was the first to come on with a question, and I'm going to direct this one at Ed because I think it fits in perfectly with a review that he did over the weekend. He says he has no room for big speakers, so what are the best smaller all-purpose speakers available?
The Morel Soundspot review went up just at the close of play on Sunday. Have to rank as some of the very smallest home cinema speakers I've ever tested. I think only Missions M Cube counts as smaller than that. Not only are they tiny, obviously they've got this nice rotating foot at the bottom, so they can be hung on a wall, you can stick them on shelves, they can go almost anywhere. And for £400 as a complete pack, you get a lot of sound for your money. I was genuinely quite pleased with how they got on. To the extent where, I'm not going to lie, a number of times when I do smaller subsat packages, I do the obligatory listening, and then it has to be said, once all the text is done and signed off and out the door, I effectively just get shot at them and put my normal speakers back in. Actually, the Morels did 10 days in situ, and they're actually very charming little speakers. But it must be said, if you just need smaller speakers, full stop, the world is your oyster at the moment. A little bit further back historically, you've got Kef's unbelievably good E305, the latest version of the Eggs. That's a stupidly good package for the money. Q Acoustics, solid players in the area. Football terminology. 7000i, fantastic. If on the off chance you were, thinking stereo, the smallest speakers, which work on their own, no need for sub, you can still mount them on the wall, and they're just ridiculously and indecently good fun to listen to, is the Neat Iota I reviewed a little while back. Don't get me wrong, they're not cheap for two little speakers. I think they're now, thanks sadly to some price rises, I think they're knocking on the door of £800. But if it's not a case of budget being restricted, just space, there is no smaller speaker that I know of, I've ever listened to, which is so convincing and so fun to listen to. They are just magic. So, yeah, you've got lots of choices.
I want to add in there, if I may, I've been using them for a long time now. Genelec, the little monitors that Genelec make, everything from... Now, I only know the old model numbers, so I'd have to look up the new model numbers, but anything from about the 6,000 range up to about the 8,000 range, which are the little active speakers. Again, you want something without a subwoofer. They are a ported design, but they're absolutely staggering. And I've been using them on the main editing system for 4 years now, and I haven't seen any reason to upgrade them, and I can turn them up pretty loud and go through to the other room, and it's like the speakers are there. Really big sound that fills the whole room, and really, you look at them and you think, well, how is that possible? How is it doing that? But they are absolutely brilliant. So I just wanted to add those in there.
No, very legit. It must be said, I've done only done a very small number of Genelec products. It's always a grey area whether they're pro or consumer audio. But as far as I can work out, I did a tiny pair years ago for another publication. And yeah, they appear to be almost completely indestructible. I have no idea what you'd have to do to them for them to stop working. They were just magnificent little things. And yeah, they're built like a Swiss watch. So yes, good shout, Mr. Hinton.
Excellent. So let's move things on a little bit quicker and go to technology expert Simon Crust. Simon, this one is aimed at you from Adam Garber. He says, which piece of tech or gadget do you wish had been more popular or is more popular? It can be from the past to the present. So which gadget? I'm kind of guessing it's going to be HD DVD, but let's see what you say.
What was the question? What gadget? What
piece of technology?
I was thinking of a tin opener.
What piece?
Which had been more successful?
Tin of. Yeah, very good. It was which piece of tech or gadget do you wish had been more popular or was more popular?
In the recent past, you hit the nail on the head. I would have said HD DVD. That should have squashed Blu-ray right at the very beginning because it was a finished design. There was no region coding. It was cheaper. It had everything going for it. I just wish that, and I loved it. I seriously loved it. I didn't fall into Blu-ray until I had to. I would have gone with HD DVD because that was a fantastic format, and I would really, really miss it even now.
Okay. Wasn't it somebody on Twitter mentioned it, and I've got to agree with them because it was a fantastic little format. I loved having it, and that was Minidisc, and I think it was David Stevens on Twitter mentioned Minidisc. Well, I used to have a head unit in the car, a Minidisc head unit. I used to have a separate player in my system. I used to love the editing features on it, and I just liked the format, and unfortunately it was one of those formats that died a death head.
Yeah, but it never knew what it wanted to be. It should have been marketed as a absolutely straightforward replacement to cassette, and someone at Sony lost the message. And it's sort of like, you know, sometimes is it a replacement for CD or what? And it was never one thing nor the other. And then it was expensive to license for other manufacturers to make the damn things, and they only had a very limited choice of mechanisms. I mean, don't get me wrong, I was a big fan of the format as well. I never went so far as to have it in my car. That is what cassette was for, surely. It had a lot going for it. I have to say, two things coming from either direction sort of killed it for me. When Yamaha released the big CD hard drive recorders that allowed me to do all the same editing that I was able to do on Minidisc, and then I could drop an absolutely 100% indistinguishable from the original copy onto a CD, that sort of knocked out the high red, you know, the high quality aspect of it. And then obviously coming from the other direction, MP3 knocked out the travel aspect of it. I mean, I do remember at university, I religiously, you know, slept around with a box of 10 mini discs and people used to go, yeah, that was, you know, that was quite an extensive collection of music to have on the go in 1999. And probably. Now obviously, wow, he's got 10 whole albums. Woo.
So Ed was sleeping with mini discs, not women, when he was at university.
Slept as in, you know, slept.
Right, is that what you meant? Okay. Steve, I heard your voice there somewhere agreeing with mini disc, did I not?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I was the same as you, Phil. I had a mini disc player in the car and everything. I'll tell you what I wish was more popular. Blu-ray.
So we've now found the two UK people who had mini disc head units on the same podcast. What are the odds, eh?
No, I wish Blu-ray was more popular. If Blu-ray was more popular, I know we all think it is, but basically we're the exceptions because we're a minority of enthusiasts. But in the general public, I don't think it is particularly popular. If it was more popular, then we'd be talking about, or even by now, maybe you've heard about a 4K Blu-ray disc format. But I think
here he goes again. Bloody 4K Blu-ray. Just drop it, Steve. Just leave it alone. Walk away.
Let it go. Just let it go.
Just walk away slowly. Right, let's go to Mark Buttright. I've got a funny feeling he's going to say the Wii U and that he's been vindicated.
You know what? I can sense the sarcasm in your voice.
It's not that difficult.
You know what? In a sense, no, because I think perhaps Wii U was a failure that that had to happen, i.e. if you release to the market with not enough support and you're overpriced for what the technology is inside, do you really want that kind of thing to be vindicated and that to be the kind of model for success? No. I'm trying to think of a piece of technology. You know what? I would go for perhaps the idea. There was a no, it doesn't count, actually. Shit.
Why does it count?
No, what I was going to say was actually technically a peripheral. There was a controller for the original Xbox, which was only for one game called Steel Battalion, and it cost about 130 quid. And then they had to obviously release a sequel for it. And it was the most extravagant, insane thing that you've ever seen released. And it, in a way, it almost kind of broke the back of the idea of kind of excessively expensive peripherals. And there was a time when it seemed like consoles and PCs were going to merge in some way, and that you would have, you know, particularly with the USB connectors coming in, you know, just one thing that would fit every device, every gaming device that you have. And slowly that's kind of moved away. There are a few arcade wheels. But if that kind of product had been a huge success, if, you know, all the kind of gaming companies had been forced to just, you know, allow everything to work, it would be just absolute utopia. One arcade stick, one wheel would do you absolutely everything, and to be future-proofed as well.
One to rule them all.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, let's wrap up on this question. Hodge?
Plasma TV, OLED TV. No, maybe a bit previous on that one. I did think of another one, but then it's just escaped me. Oh, it was the Wii U as well. Yeah, that's it. Not really any notable things that I lament the passing of. Let's just move on.
What, the 90s maybe?
The 90s, yeah. I can't remember them.
All right, and a final one, which is directed at Steve. This one from Dave Stevens. Or is it David Stevens? I don't want to upset the guy by calling him Dave if he's not Dave, if you know what I mean. Are acoustically transparent screens worth it as opposed to some white spandex?
are people using white spandex?
I had to check the forums, and yes, there is a conversation in there about using spandex as a screen, as an acoustically transparent screen.
Can you buy spandex on the roll, then? Or just buy a pair of leotards from some out of work?
Well, that's why I've come to you, because you're the most likely ass five to know.
I'm not a big fan of wrestling, although if you did borrow The Rock's spandex outfit, being he's a big lad, probably could cover an entire screen with that material, especially if you stretched it really tight.
Chances of a skid mark down the centre, though.
yeah, there could be some staining. That's true. All right. I must admit, using spandex as a cheap alternative for a screen as opposed to just painting the wall white is a new one on me. Ideally, I'd always recommend, you know, if you're going to get a decent projector, buy a proper screen.
I would always agree with that. And I think acoustically transparent screens, what you really need to be careful of is the weave in the material.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they've got advantages, right, Phil? I mean, you can put speakers behind screens, obviously, which means
totally.
Dialogue and effects are screen-specific, and you can't see the speakers, which gives that nice cinema feel to it. But you're absolutely right. If the weave is too big, or you're blowing the image up too much, and the weave is the same size as the pixels, it can give you moiré effects. It can really bugger up your image.
Yeah.
So you need to be very careful. I mean, basically, you can't skimp on an acoustically transparent
screen. The thing that people forget as well, they concentrate on the sound aspect of it being acoustically transparent. What they forget is that the light is also going through the holes. It's also going through the weave. So you do lose quite a bit of light that doesn't actually come back off the screen as well. So an acoustically transparent screen will always be dimmer. I'm trying to think what gain my screen is. I've got acoustically transparent screen. It's a screen excellence with in lighter 4K material, so you can't see the weave even up close. It's almost impossible to see it, and it works fantastically well. Not that cheap, and I've got an acoustically transparent screen, but I haven't got any room to put the speakers behind it. Figure that one out, if you will. but yeah, you've got to remember that fact as well, that obviously the light's going to go through it easier than a solid screen, and it's always better paying for a properly designed screen. You want to make sure that you're actually reflecting enough light back in, back into the viewing position as well, so you're not losing stuff. You don't want too much reflectiveness on the surface, otherwise you get hot spotting and so on. Steve, something that you suffered from with a Stuart screen because it was too high a gain for your room, wasn't it?
And yeah, when I originally bought it, it was for a room with lighter coloured walls. Once I put it into a pitch black room, it was really apparent. When it never had been before. So yeah, you need to be careful of that. Also, if you're going to get a cushy transparent screen, really you want to go scope ratio, because if you've got a 1.85:1 transparent screen, you might find, depending on how big it is, that the speakers are all pretty close together and you lose some stereo separation.
I would never put left, depending on how big the 1.85:1 screen was, I would never put the left and right speakers behind the screen in that kind of setup. In a scope setup, yes, I would.
You can get away with it, yeah.
And there's something to be said about not being able to see speakers. And I don't know if this is something that you've found, Ed, but if you can't see where the sound's coming from, if you can't see the speaker in your peripheral vision, then there's just something about the sound stage. It feels more alive. It comes to life a bit more, and it really, you know, has a really strange effect.
You're touching on two psychological issues, for me at least, certainly. Cinema, yes, I completely agree. It's very interesting, actually. I was down at a dealer in Dorset earlier last week, and they've got a full fat home cinema demo room, a really, really beautifully kitted out one, it must be said. Anamorphic lens, a projector the size of a fridge. From my sort of layperson's point of view, it looked the business, and the demonstration was extremely effective as well. And it was interesting, they were feeding back that although they can demonstrate box loudspeakers in the room, they always feel, in terms of how the customer perceives and what generally people end up going for, you're absolutely right. A concealed or installed speaker in that sort of context always works extraordinarily well. And there's an interesting sort of jump to this. I don't want to deviate, I don't want to waste too much time, but if you have a very distracting piece of source equipment in a system, that also colours your perception of what you're doing. Now, in AV, that's not too much of a problem. In two-channel, if you've got some of the turntables that are on sale at the moment, which, you know, are just giant chrome-plated, you know, cross between an alien spaceship and an oil rig, honestly, reviewing them or critically appraising them is incredibly hard. I have to make arrangements to screen them off when I'm trying to critically appraise how they sound, because I am, and I think most other human beings that are interested in those sort of things, you're unavoidably led by them, just the astonishing appearance of what it's doing whilst it's actually playing. And that's, you know, that's a really bizarre one. So, yeah, if you actually want to enjoy the music or the film or, you know, whatever it is you're replaying, you need to make sure that the electronics, the system and the interface is as unobtrusive as possible. You don't want that to be the story. You want what it's producing to be the story. And yeah, you're 100% right for that, for me.
Is there somebody dying in the background?
I think that's my wife, but I think she's all right. If I hear a thud, I'll go and help her.
She got the cold or something?
The whole house is riven by plague. Right. It's just as well these things aren't transferable by VoIP line.
Right, so obviously this is something that we might come back. I think is really interesting, the whole science behind it and perception and all the rest. I think it's really fascinating. It's probably something we're going to come back to. But hopefully, David, that didn't answer anything that you asked, because we've never used white spandex for screens, so we can only tell you what acoustically transparent screens are like.
And Steve can tell you how comfortable it is, but that's probably not so helpful under the circumstances.
Probably. Right. I think that wraps everything up for hardware, and it has been a long one this week, and we're going to move quickly to games news next. So, Mark, we've already mentioned that E3 is up next week between the 10th and the 12th of June. You're going to have a whole podcast all about it. You're also going to have a roundtable thing going up soon. So what can people expect from this year's E3?
Well, obviously, with Microsoft cutting out the Kinect from the Xbox One, as well as a few different kind of policy changes and lots of changes going on behind the scenes. The two big next-gen consoles will be on a level footing. So this year, finally, it can be more a story about the games. Last year was very much the narrative was about the new hardware and about the differences and the like. This year, it's going to be more focused on kind of who's got the best exclusives and the like. But it has to be said, both consoles are slightly struggling on that count. I think the extra time necessary to develop for the next gen systems is something that's taking its toll. And so really you're looking towards the kind of Christmas push when both will hoping to be able to kind of gain traction and properly put the last generation of consoles, which was still doing well, kind of in their rear view mirror. One of the key ones is Halo, obviously. You've got Halo remastered, you've got The Last of Us remastered. So, you know, everyone's scrabbling around for something from the back catalogue. And just today, or if today's Wednesday, that makes it 2 days ago, the Walking Dead and The Wolf Among Us, it's been announced they're going to get a next-gen release. So it seems like very much remasterings on the cards, and new IP may well be quite thin on the ground. But you should still see, you know, some of the big hitters, God of War, Gears of War, you know, all the kind of games that you've come to associate with the PS3 and 360 generation. And then there's also the key prospect of VR making itself known properly at this show, with Oculus Rift being bought out by Facebook, with Sony's reply to that, with Project Morpheus. Who knows, perhaps we may even see something from Microsoft if they could somehow incorporate a headset that used, say, the Kinect sensor for head tracking. You know, that could actually sell the peripheral. So, yeah, there's lots of things going on. The only real thing that we know for certain is that there will be various games that we talked about last year that we've still been waiting to see more of, and that Nintendo basically won't be there with any real presence.
I have a mild question, if it's permitted.
Only a mild one?
It's only a mild one, because I have to say, it's one of those things where I'm watching this as an observer from the outside looking in. Obviously, in recent, I don't exactly know when it was released, but it's not that long ago, we had Watch Dogs launch. And it was a bit of an interesting one, because my Twitter feed, in its own limited way, there was a sort of flurry of excitement from the people who actually, you know, play the things. And it just sort of got more and more jaded, and it did so amazingly quickly. And as I understand it, this was one of the sort of more, I don't know if it's, you know, it wasn't a massively important next gen release, but it was still, if you like, a sort of significant one. And it just seemed to be that the sheen of all the things that were supposed to make it a sort of next-gen-y game seemed to wear off quite quickly, and then people got annoyed about the basic aspects of it being a game. And, I'm just wondering if, you know, it's obviously not something that E3 is going to tackle, because they, you know, you don't want to do anything other than be as positive as possible at these sort of conferences. But at the end of the day, these are machines for playing games, and it does strike me that in the efforts to, you know, bump up graphics, bump up various other features and stuff, that they're not necessarily bringing people along with actual enjoyment playing the things, which is presumably the point of it, unless I'm missing something.
Well, no, I mean, it's interesting that you raise that, because, I mean, last year was quite notable, because one of the key kind of battlegrounds between the two big next-gen consoles was about indie gaming. Indie games, who's managed to grab the kind of most support from smaller studios. And there was this real sense that was the scene that was applying the most kind of new way of thinking, trying to create something new in the field of gaming. However, there is also a kind of prevailing sense of, you know, I've spent best part of £400 on something, I want it to blow my socks off. And I think with Watch Dogs, I think part of the jaded sense was this was something that was shown with fantastic graphics. People then felt that they were slightly downgraded. A lot of the kind of gameplay mechanics have been seen before. People expect, it's weird, people expect new things from new consoles, which is it's like expecting new films when you get a new film format or something. You know, it doesn't often happen. You know, when people started making films in 3D, they expected something inherently different rather than something that was simply slightly tweaked at best.
Okay, so that's E3. Like we say, it's coming up next week from the 10th to the 12th. There'll be lots of coverage on the forums, in the editorial, on the homepage, and, of course, there will be a games podcast. So coming up next is the AV Snack.
Like there was a question mark at the end of that.
It was. He wasn't sure. I've researched
the AV snack.
It's not an AV snack. It's a it's a World Cup snack, because we can cash in on the World Cup here. So if Steve assigned me to the mission of finding a World Cup snack.
Cup winning snack.
Have
you actually started, Mark?
No, I've got a Brazilian. This is assured by
a Brazilian or a Brazilian.
Brazilian. Brazilian. This is Brazilian's national snack, I'm assured.
Brazil's national snack.
By the internet. I've never made it, but it sounds easy enough. So this is called, my best Portuguese, a pão de queijo, I believe. I've not actually heard it said, but that's what it looks like to me on paper. So it's kind of like a cheesy dough ball, which, just to please Steve, if you made out a really bright cheese, you'd be able to see it in the dark. It's very simple indeed. It just takes an egg, about 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 200 to 300 mils of milk, some tapioca flour, which is slightly unusual, but I have seen it. So it's gluten-free as well, tapioca flour. So that's a good one for the gluten sufferers out there. And then some cheese, a handful, I would suggest, of anything you like. But if you want to see it in the dark, something very bright. A teaspoon of salt. Bang it in a blender, whiz it up, and then pour out into some greased muffin tins. Bake on gas mark 6, 200°C.
You laugh at it, greased muffin.
What's wrong with a greased muffin tin? Anyway, bake it for 15, 20 minutes until they're golden brown, puffed up, and then you can. As you're finding this, very funny smell. I don't understand. And then you can just dip it in whatever you like when you're done.
God, you make this shit up as you go along, don't you?
I don't know. This is a national dish of Brazil. They'll all be eating them out there when they're watching the football. Trust me. If you see someone sticking a cheesy puff in their mouth, do not be surprised.
Sticking a cheesy puff in their mouth.
Is it a traditional recipe to bang it in a blender and whiz it up?
That's what they do now in Brazil. You could just stir it with a spoon, but, you know, it's not the third. Well, is it the third world? But they have, some of them will have blenders, the more affluent ones.
The AV Forums podcast, only slightly racist.
Only slightly. Maybe the second world, to be fair. I don't know. But, yeah, that's it. And they eat them all the time, the Brazilians, I promise. But it's Brazilian, and it looks like a football when you're done. There you go. On message, as ever. Don't rate it.
It sounds very appealing, actually.
It will be nice. How many people in Brazil? Top of your head. And they all eat them. They can't all be wrong. It's one of the most populated countries on earth. They can't be wrong about this.
Or buy a bag of Brazil nuts. There you go.
Okay, time for some cinema news. And Steve, seeing as we are running late, you've got 3 films to get through in 3 minutes. Off you go.
4 films to get through in 3 minutes. Because, like buses, they all seem to turn up at the same time. So since the last podcast, I've seen X-Men, Days of Futures Past, which is directed by Bryan Singer. Good solid 8 out of 10. I think not quite as amazing as Kaz makes it out in his review, but it does is quite successful in fixing most of the continuity errors that Fox have created with all their various X-Men movies over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, and largely erases the bad memories of X-Men The Last Stand, which was the third one directed by Brett Ratner. So, yeah, it's got some great set pieces in it. It's got quite a clever story, you know, with time travel and everything in it, and it combines both the first class younger cast and the more established cast from the original X-Men movies very successfully, and overall I really enjoyed it, so that's a good one. We've got Maleficent, which opened last Wednesday, a week ago, and that stars Angelina Jolie as the villain from the animated movie Sleeping Beauty. So it's basically a live action version, an alternative take on the story. So it's the same story, but from a different perspective. So it's shown from the point of view of the villain. And it's definitely one of those sort of modern films where there seems to be a lot of emphasis on backstory more than there ever used to be in the past, and also upon about making the villains more sympathetic. I generally blame George Lucas for a lot of this. He seems to have been big on backstory these days and also making sympathetic villains. And this is a good example. But it's actually a really good movie. I really enjoy it. I thought Angelina Jolie is absolutely brilliant in it. She just looks like the physical embodiment of the cartoon character. She's perfect in the role and reminds you that she's actually a really good actress. And I think this is her first film since The Tourist 4 years ago. And she is superb in it. It looks great. It's really well made. It did have a lot of problems. I know there were reshoots on it, and it had a first-time director. But the results, certainly, the money's on the screen, and it looks great. And I thoroughly, much to my surprise, I really enjoyed it. I give that at least 7 out of 10. A Million Ways to Die in the West. Seth MacFarlane's follow-up to Ted. And massively disappointed with this one. I was really looking forward to this. I thought it looked quite funny in the trailers. But it's basically, you know, what would have been a very funny half-hour episode of Family Guy with Stewie and Brian going back in time to find out how dangerous the Old West used to be. That would have been quite funny. Stretching it out for 2 hours, the joke gets used over it. Basically, people get killed all the time. You know, they get shot in gunfights, or they get run over by a cow, or they get bitten by a rattlesnake, or, you know, or killed by the doctor. Basically, yes, people died all the time in the West. It was a very unhealthy place to be. But that's the joke that gets rammed home over the course of 2 hours constantly. And unfortunately, given the talent that's involved in this film, not just Seth MacFarlane, but you've got, Charlize Theron, Liam Neeson, who actually, those two are probably the best out of the cast. And they're the ones that, you know, are not established comic actors, if you like. It should have been a lot funnier, and it wasn't. It was a real disappointment. There are some laughs in there, don't get me wrong. And there's some chuckles, but it's nowhere near as funny as Ted was. And I think MacFarlane playing the lead as himself, you know, as an actor, was a bad idea. He should have got someone else to play the part. I think he's better off behind the scenes or using his voice for, you know, things like, well, with Ted, for example, an animated teddy bear, he was fine. But with this, was a real disappointment. And then finally, Edge of Tomorrow, which is the new Tom Cruise movie based upon a Japanese novel called All You Need Is Kill, which was a much better title in my opinion. And it's basically Groundhog Day with guns. He ends up in a situation where he keeps repeating the same day over and over again, progressively getting better. It involves an alien invasion of Earth, and they're attacking. Basically, they're recreating D-Day, which is interesting because that's the anniversary on this Friday. You know, they've got a beach attack, basically very similar in style to the same Private Ryan sequence at the beginning of that film. And he has to keep going through this assault over and over and over again, gradually learning more. For various reasons that become apparent in the plot, I don't want to give too much away. Really enjoyed it. Really good film. And lovely, really good look to it. Interesting story. Good cast, both Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt are excellent in it. The action scenes, special effects are great. I definitely give that a good 8 out of 10. I thought it was a great movie. I really enjoyed it. I'm not totally convinced by the ending, but otherwise, I thought it was a really, really interesting film. And certainly different, which makes a nice change these days. Of all those films, I'd say that was the one I've enjoyed the most in the last week and a half.
Okay, so if people are skinting, they can only afford to go and see one of them. Which one would you say is the one that they have to go see?
Well, if you're an X-Men fan, obviously you want to go and see Days of Futures Past, because I think Bryan Singer does a really good job of tying everything together in that movie. But if you're not bothered about X-Men and you fancy something a bit different, I'd go and see Edge of Tomorrow. If you've got kids, Maleficent would be good for the children too. I think they'd enjoy that.
So all of them then?
Basically, everything but A Million Ways to Die in the West, unfortunately.
Okay, quickly, Simon, take us through the Blu-rays that are coming up.
I don't know. True Detective, I've no idea what that is.
That's a TV series. What? You what? You haven't seen it? Oh, you need to see this, Simon. It is one of the best TV series of the year so far. You really have to see it. Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey, Woody Harrelson, HBO series.
HBO, okay.
It is fantastic.
It's awesome. Yes.
Okay, in fact, the other discs that are out, Lone Survivor, The Monuments Men, Robocop, Cuban Fury, can forget all them. Get True Detective and you'll be blown away. That, I think that wraps it all up, didn't it?
you convinced me. Yeah, all right, okay. Yeah.
Okay,
True Detective, season one, HBO.
Right, okay. Thumbs up. I'm going to play an ident now. We're going to come back and talk movies again in a bit. And we're back again. Right. To wrap up on this week's podcast, Empire Magazine did their usual 301 films, the best films or whatever it was. They got the readers. They claim 250,000. Really? That's what they claim anyway. And the best film of them all, of best film ever made, according to the readers, as The Empire Strikes Back. I agree wholeheartedly, and that's that finished with and over with and done.
So, Empire's how many times did you vote in that?
I am joking, of course. There's no way The Empire Strikes Back is the best film ever made. It may be on my top 10 list. It might even be number one personally, because that's a childhood memory for me. It's a film I can go back to time and time again, like Jaws and like The Godfather and stuff. So, was this list, and it's on the homepage for people to go and look at while they're listening to this. This is a popularity contest, and it's nothing to do with good quality films, Steve.
No, absolutely, Phil. What it does is it reflects the demographic makeup of the people that voted on this particular poll. I think, you know, clearly they're 30 to 40 year old blokes, judging by the films that are on this list. Because when you look, you know, top 10 films of all time, and I think making lists of bests of anything is always subjective anyway, but you know, any list that doesn't include Casablanca or Citizen Kane or Lawrence of Arabia or Vertigo clearly is suspect.
You forgot your favorite.
What, Star Wars?
No, your ruby slippers, Steve. Your ruby slippers.
Wizard of Oz.
Yep. Yeah.
Or The Wizard of Oz, good one. Or Gone with the Wind. Or, you know, there's any number of other films that could have made that list. They didn't mention The Godfather Part Two, even though The Godfather, I think, was on that list. Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously, it's purely a popularity poll. I mean, there were two Christopher Nolan films in that top 10, Inception and The Dark Knight. I mean, again, I mean, really? Top 10 best films ever made? Come on, seriously? No. It's just depressing that it's so, the majority of the films are,
No, I just think you've hit on the nail on the head. It's a demographic, Ed, isn't it? And it's the fact that those are the people who read, those are the people who vote. They've grown up with these films, and there's a few new ones in there because there's probably a slight skew to that. Oh, well, I've got to put something new in the list. When you're talking about classic films, I don't think it was ever set out to be a classic film survey. It's always going to be populist, and to be honest, I mean, I would watch every single film on the list because they're all really good films, but they're not what you'd call classics. Or are we being snobbish by saying that?
I don't know how voting was carried out, but did you only get to vote for one film, or did you put in a top 10?
No idea, Ed.
Because I suspect what's going on was actually what I call the Supergrass effect. The band Supergrass, they've released some magnificent albums, but they are everyone's third. They, you know, during the time they were actually really, you know, sort of out and about and releasing stuff, they were everyone's third favorite band. So if people had to submit 10 films, Empire is almost certainly going to wind up number one, simply because it probably cropped up on far more top tens than any other film. But whether it consistently came into people's number one, I think it annoys the least number of people. So by dint of it doing that, it winds up at the top of the list. Whereas, let's face it, we, you know, all of our favourite films, it's a much more personal thing. And if everyone here was to say their favourite film, statistically, with six of us or however many in the podcast, at least one other person would then go, that's absolute bobbins and I don't agree with you at all.
Yeah.
Totally. Whereas Empire will go, yeah, we could all sit down and watch Empire.
Yeah.
That, I think that's how it works.
We're talking about the difference here, though, between favourite and best.
Yeah, well, that's another distinction. It's not really made, is it? So
yeah.
There are lots of things I love that I would never go out of my way to say that's the best there is.
Yeah. Jaws.
I don't know. I think you ought to have the courage of your convictions there.
No, I know that some of the things that I like are absolute trash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do yourself down.
Well, actually, it's a good point you make there, Mark, because it was something that was raised when we were at Netflix a few weeks ago. Sorry, I've said the N-word. Yes,
we almost made it. We always made it
to an hour without saying the N-word. But anyway, the point I was going to make was obviously they work on their algorithm, which works on you know, what it is that you actually like in terms of films and what it's going to recommend that you watch based on what's within their catalogue of films and TV series and so on. And that the way that they build that up is by not what you rate films as, because that's never accurate. What they do is they actually watch what you watch and draw all the samples from that, because you won't admit to yourself what your guilty pleasures are and the kind of stuff that you watch. And to make it more accurate and to recommend stuff that is more in line with what you're actually going to watch, is they watch what you're watching, not what you're rating on their system, which is really quite clever and actually really quite true.
Yeah. It works, because my Netflix list is as long as your arm. I'm never going to get through them all. So it obviously works.
I've finally run out of person of interest episodes.
I've stalled on that now. It's gone a bit formulaic for me. Definitely not the best TV show ever made. It's good, but
End of season two, cracking.
Right, okay, so getting back to how this list's coming about, before we go completely off track, but it's a good way of working things out. It's definitely a favouritism thing, Simon, isn't it? I mean, looking at that list, there's no Nosferatu, so it doesn't appeal to you.
No, but I have just looked through. I mean, the entire list is 301 films, not just this top 10. The top 10 is very almost teenage in its listing.
Well, there isn't a film older than 1971 on that list, which is depressing.
It kind of does put a demographic on who's been voting. But if you go back beyond even just the top 10, you start to see Godfather Part 2, Goodfellas, Aliens, Apocalypse Now, 2001, Big Lebowski, Casablanca, Lawrence of Arabia. They're all there. They're just further down.
Yeah.
The list itself is pretty comprehensive, and I suppose of a list of 301 films, it's going to be pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, so it's just the ordering of that, and like Ed's already explained, you know, there are ways in which The Empire Strikes Back was always going to end up as number one, probably, when you take things into account. Steve, is there a foolproof way of ever doing a list like this, or?
I don't think there is, Phil. Ultimately, it's going to come down to personal preference, isn't it? I mean, you could. What can you use? Otherwise, you could use criteria like box office or awards, but then, no, they're hardly great indicators of quality either. So, at the end of the day, I mean, traditionally, there's been an annual poll of critics for their best film ever made. And for years and years and years and years and years, that was Citizen Kane. It won every year. And last year was the first year, or maybe the year before, it was the first year that Citizen Kane didn't win Best Film on this various critics poll. And it was actually usurped by Vertigo. And it's interesting that both of those films were not successful when they came out. Citizen Kane was a massive failure. And then became, you know, after the fact, he became a huge hit. Critically acclaimed. And by the same token, Vertigo was hugely misunderstood in the time that it came out in the 50s, and now it's become critically acclaimed.
Is that not apocryphal about Citizen Kane being a massive failure?
Oh, no, it was a critical and commercial flop at the time.
Ooh. But not
it won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay. That was it. It suffered partly because William Randolph Hearst was the model for Kane himself. And apparently his nickname for his mistress's clitoris was Rosebud. So it was a bit of an in-joke on the part of... Apparently, this is true. Is it an in-joke on the part of Wells? Yeah. And Hearst was obviously pissed off. And he used his massive publishing empire to hammer the film. So Wells, I think Wells's hubris, you know, did him in the end. But it's...
What you got to remember about Kane, though, was it had the Star Wars effect in the technical sense of how cinema was made. It's one of those standout films that had so many firsts, technically.
So I can hear music. Why can I hear music?
Because somebody's probably getting a piano lesson at Ed's.
Actually, no, it's my wife playing the harp.
All right, there you go.
I'm not making that up. My wife is actually playing a harp.
That's not a euphemism, though.
No, it's not a euphemism. It's a 22-string lever harp. What can I say? I live the most middle-class existence in the history of the known universe. I'm in a good place with that now. I just accept it.
Okay, well, I
forgot what I was talking about now.
Yeah, we forgot
What I was saying was, I think it'll be interesting if maybe in 50 years' time when people look back, that a film that maybe has been a massive failure recently will be looked back as being a great classic. So
I look forward to the Lone Ranger receiving the recognition it so richly deserves.
I already think John Carter's a classic. That was a much misunderstood and much maligned movie, in my opinion.
Still on my to-watch list, actually.
That pile's pretty big, though, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, it's about twice the size of me now.
Yeah, but you are only 3 for 8.
The funny thing about Empire is that whilst it is a well-made movie, it's fundamentally flawed because it hasn't got a beginning and it hasn't got an end. And it only really works if the third film is good. And unfortunately, the third film was Jedi and Jedi's
Fallen. Let's not get started on Jedi. Let's move on swiftly. Actually, I think we've kind of run out of time on this week's podcast. So before we go talking about film lists, it's something that Simon and Kaz have been working on recently. So we got our own list coming up. Well, I say our own, it's you and Kaz who've kind of put this together. So there's two lists there. Tell us what they are and what we can expect from them.
Three lists. Yeah, there's top 20 3D Blu-rays to own, top 20 AV specific Blu-rays to own, and the top 50 Blu-rays to own. Now, the Blu-rays takes into consideration the film and not just the technical aspects, so that's why it's that much bigger. But we are going to have a slight trouble in putting it in number 1 to 50. We might just say they're all one. Can we do that?
I laugh at the top one is Vampire Strikes Back.
It's not like you're sitting on the fence at all, is it, Simon?
Absolutely not.
Get some commitment from you.
We have slightly fudged it in the fact that we've used box sets as well. So, for example, we say the Star Wars box set, so that encompasses all six films.
That's on your list. Yeah, the films is shit, the picture quality is shit, the audio is shit, and the extras is shit. I would sooner set fire to the than put it on a list.
Say what you think, Steve. Don't hold back. You know.
And on that bombshell.
The bleep machine's melted.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, boys, but I just couldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, wait till it's published, and then you can rip it to bits on the forums.
Absolutely.
Anyway, that's all we got time for the podcast this week. My thanks to Steve Withers.
We don't know, but it comes out of the basketball court.
Mark Hodgkinson.
You picked the wrong house, Bob.
Mark Botwright.
Guten Tag.
Simon Crust.
I've got my eyes on you.
And Ed Selly.
Continue smoking that in here, and you'll spend the rest of your days under the belief that you're a six-year-old girl.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark AV Forums, the latest reviews, news and video, and why not leave us a rating on iTunes if you enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again next Wednesday.